Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the reality TV ambush of Schumer and Pelosi that Trump staged at the White House yesterday in a stunt designed to distract the public from the fact that Trump does not have an infrastructure plan, or any other plan for that matter, except to feed the voracious appetite of television and Twitter every day with increasingly desperate doses of manufactured drama, serial stunts, and cheap cliffhangers. Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation, joins us to discuss Trump's feral grasp of our fractured and fragmented media environment of cable news and social media, while the Democratic opposition appears to be back in the analog age of neoliberal failure, stuck with the 18th century belief that he who has the best argument wins. Now, instead of living up to his pledge to defend and protect the Constitution, we have the unprecedented condition of a president actively breaking the law to goad the Democrats into impeaching him. With Marshall McLuhan's adage that the medium is the message now truer than ever, we will speculate when the public will grow tired of Trump's act and whether Nancy Pelosi's prayers will be answered, since she just said, quote, "I pray for the President of the United States. I wish that his family or his administration or his staff would have an intervention for the good of the country." Then we'll examine the proposition that intelligence is no guarantee against stupidity and look into some of the weird and wacky, terrifying and hilarious top secret projects that the U.S. intelligence agencies and the military came up with during World War II and the Cold War. Vince Houghton, the historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington and author of the new book just out, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board, joins us to discuss some of our greatest misfires in the name of national defense. Starting with Acoustic Kitty, we will explore how bats with tiny firebombs attached were meant to burn down Tokyo, but instead ended up burning down a U.S. base, along with the many madcap schemes to kill Castro, and the tunnel the CIA and the NSA built under the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C. But perhaps the crowning jewel of bizarre boondoggles is the Air Force's 1958 plan to let off a hydrogen bomb on the moon to somehow let the Soviets know we could counter their surprise success with Sputnik. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's the former managing editor of Ramparts and was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Nice to be with you. Nice to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Richard. And yesterday, we really had, I've been saying this for some time, that with Donald Trump, you have government by stunt, to, you know, sort of reality TV guy trying to disguise the fact that he doesn't know how to govern. But yesterday was really an extraordinary example of government by stunt. He invited Schumer and Pelosi over to the White House. They go into the cabinet room. They notice that the blinds and curtains have been drawn, which, of course, the room looks out on the Rose Garden, and that's a bit odd. And then then the meeting lasts for 3 minutes, and he storms out and goes straight to a prepared address in the Rose Garden with signs all pre-prepared and has his photo up where he rants against the Democrats and blames them for everything. And what clearly happened there was they were supposed to talk about infrastructure, but Trump does not have an infrastructure plan. So instead of a real plan, he had a tantrum and a stunt. So is this what the United States government has become?
Well, you know, I mean, communicating ideas has always been as important as ideas, and I don't want to become a mouthpiece for Marshall McLuhan, which is a name that I think is probably hackneyed to people my age and maybe unknown to younger listeners. But the idea that the medium is the message is one that has become more and more and more important, it seems to me, as more and more of whatever information we experience or gather is mediated for us by forms of corporate organization that have their own specific logic. The idea of a book is that it's an object which is oftentimes created commercially by a printer, by an author, et cetera. But it then takes on a static form, that is of letters printed on pages, and it's consumed usually in the silence of a room where one is cut off from outside noise. And so a kind of conversation between the imagination of the reader and the imagination of the writer that has been poured into those words becomes, for many of us, the kind of defining mode or the defining ground of what it means to communicate in the most profound sense. Now, there are other ways of doing this. There are things like dance. There are things like prayer or meditation. But I think, you know, for the last 500 years, with the growth of literacy, particularly the last 100 years, the global growth of literacy, that fundamental idea of reading has been the grounding norm for what we think of as the ways we communicate. But in the post-Second World War period, and then the last 30 years, we've come to an era in which television, and now in the last 5 or 10 years, social media and the internet have redefined the ground. And the nature of television is that the commercial logic that intervenes between the person who's producing, that is, an analog would be to the author, and the person who is receiving, that would be the reader, the analog, has been fundamentally transformed. The presence of the intermediary and the desire of the intermediary to translate immediately our attention to the subject into commercial benefit is everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It exists in the very idea of television and television commercials and a 30-minute program really being, what, a 23-minute program or a 20-minute program, with the rest formally being filled with commercials. And then within the program itself, oftentimes commercial references to products or the design of a stage set or the clothing what one wears, or now even in athletics, where it seems to me every time I turn on a sports event, everybody is wearing a corporately labeled set of tennis shoes or shirts or jackets or helmets, such that everything about the intermediation of consumption and corporation is the defining feature of that connection. So that's an entirely new ground relatively in terms of human history. I can't think of Shakespeare worrying about whether the Nike swoop was on, you know, the uniform of Julius Caesar. That kind of corporate branding was just not at all a part of human consciousness. It is now. And I think that the tragic thing for me is that now with the internet, and also with a new style of television that moves through rapid cutting and a conscious manipulation of the unconscious in terms of the way we process information, we've lost the sense of the linear that was such a helpful contribution of reading and of writing, and have substituted kind of an informational gestalt or experience in which it's the mood or the stance or the posture or the style that emerges out of our encounter that is what defines it, and also then what in turn makes it commercially valuable.
But what's particularly extraordinary is that we have a president now who's effectively breaking the law. He's encouraging lawbreaking because he's basically taunting the Democrats into impeaching them. He wants to be impeached. So he is literally breaking the law and will continue to break the law in order to get impeached, because in his reality TV mind, that will be good for him. I don't think we've ever had a situation like that, have we? I mean, presidents normally protect and defend the Constitution. They don't violate it.
Well, again, I mean, the Constitution is a written document. I want to go back to the absolute centrality of writing and the ways in which the sentence, the paragraph, the text are so important to the ways in which human reason has evolved and the ways in which collective human reason and human reasoning and human mutual understanding have evolved. And you're exactly right. We're in a critical moment. A key turning in the culture in which this fellow is a master of the new television era, and the, even more as he plays with Twitter, a master of the even more sort of cosmically disconnected world of social media.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's the former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. And his books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. And, of course, Nancy Pelosi herself is under pressure from her own caucus and a growing chorus of Democrats who want to impeach him. What's your sense of whether or not? My sense is that a lot of the rank and file Democrats are angry about what happened with Hillary Clinton losing to Donald Trump,
and they're angry with Mueller and not doing more.
Right, and then but if they blow this one in 2020, I would suggest that the Democratic rank and file will just abandon the Democratic Party. They simply can't afford to lose this. Yet my sense is that they are struggling, to say the least, to come up with a narrative. And I don't know whether his reality TV stunts will get stale. He'll run out of tricks. But at this point, he does seem to be running rings around them.
Well, amorality has its advantages. Immorality has even advantages over amorality, because the logic is the logic of the marketplace, which is you're selling something. And what you're selling in the case of Trump is Trump himself and the recognition that he constantly craves, that he is the best seller of Trump or any product that he so designates of all those who sell. He is a machine that is a creation of the capitalist world, and that world's encounter with the total commodification of everything in the world. I mean, you know, 150 years ago, for an economist like Alfred Marshall to be sketching out the fundamentals of neoclassical economic theory, he thought he was talking about a world that was defined by the marketplace. But the marketplace was only one of many worlds in which we lived. He didn't think of the family as being a unit of the marketplace. He didn't think of religion as being a form of the marketplace. He didn't think of the university as being an arena for the marketplace. But the advance of a kind of soulless and morally uncentered market worship has meant that there is nowhere in human life that isn't a candidate for commodification, objectification, and sale.
So what do you think then that Pelosi, she seems to be the de facto leader of the Democrats. I mean, I think she's doing
it. Certainly of the House Democrats.
Yeah. Well, but you've got this crowded field. I mean, after this ridiculous stunt that yesterday, Pelosi said, "I pray for the President of the United States. I wish that his family or his administration or his staff would have an intervention for the good of the country." I've often speculated that Trump won't leave the Oval Office in an orange jumpsuit or a straitjacket, but he might actually have a public meltdown like Howard Beale in Network. What would your prediction be? Because we've just got through saying how clever he is in a feral kind of way. He always seems to be able to write the script and have the Democrats thrown off balance, and that continues to be the case. And I think him and Barr have done an incredibly good job of blunting the impact of the Mueller report. So you can sense a sense of frustration on the part of the Democrats. How do we get this guy? Because he's so gettable. But then that was the case back with Hillary Clinton. It was like, how could you lose to this guy?
Right. Well, a couple of things, Ian. I mean, first, I'd say you know, you were pointing to his feral qualities. I think that what we talk about when we speak about his genius is a particular kind of genius, which is his total alienation from the rest of us as as human subjects deserving of respect and dignity and even love. What he embodies, what he personifies, is the objectification of all. The objectification of his wife, the objectification of his bizarre sexualized objectification of his daughter, the way in which he objectifies those around him so that they're pure instruments without their own extant humanity or even consistent identity. So at one point, his lawyer Cohen is the great genius of the American legal system. The minute Cohen turns against him, Cohen becomes a completely unqualified hack. And nobody who would think about the consistency of narrative would think that Trump could get away with it. But again, if what you are is a child or a creation or a misformed creature of this post-reading, post-written world that we're so much in, that inconsistency isn't even a damaging accusation when we level it against him, because he's so alienated from the very idea of consistency that is part of the power of the written word. So I think that I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm an economist, and so I can't tell you exactly how to diagnose him. I certainly talked with psychiatrists and psychologists here at Harvard, and there are a number of them who think that he fits within a clinical diagnosis of an extremely aberrant personality. The argument is, what category in the psychological rankings and identifications he fits in, but there's no sense in which he doesn't display aberrant personal characteristics. I think the question is, what is the alternative narrative that the presidential candidate chosen by the Democratic Party will bring to bear? The crisis that Clinton represented for the Democratic Party was that large parts of the Democratic Party had moved past her and the neoliberalism that she and her husband represented. They were creatures of the long Reagan era, and in a sense, an attempt to keep the Democratic Party relevant by adopting some of the characteristics of the marketeering Reagan Republicanism of the 1980s. Trump is an exaggerated caricature of that very world. And what we don't know is who will be the candidate that can point a majority of voters past that world. She was clearly caught behind that world, and his genius was to, in some sense, exploit through contempt, a kind of feral, I don't want to say contempt, but a distrust that had evolved about the Clinton persona and about the Clinton neoliberalism as a logic. But you can't turn to Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie or others and expect that they represent at this moment a large enough number of voters that they can overwhelm Trump. But the Democratic Party has to go through that process of transforming itself into a post-neoliberal party, but naming what that conjunction or that constellation of ideas and forces and groups is at the moment is part of the dilemma that the party's facing.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's turn to the Republican Party, because it's a total puzzlement that the party of Soviet haters and red baiters is now making excuses for Putin. They're turning a blind eye to whatever is going on between Trump and Putin. You mentioned Cohen 1 minute was a hero and then a villain. Mm-hmm. The same is true of Rex Tillerson, Trump's first Secretary of State. He praised him to the hilt when he appointed him, and now today he's tweeting out all kinds of insults because Tillerson told the Congress, the Foreign Relations Committee, about what actually happened in these meetings with Putin, how Putin ran rings around him. So you would think to yourself, just as an average American would, out of some sort of patriotic impulse, would say, well, the guy that's supposed to be the steward of our national security is getting smoked by this bad guy in the Kremlin. But why? Why are the Republicans absolutely silent? Or are they in some kind of complicity? We have questions whether...
Well, I mean, you can read this landscape probably better than I. And I mean, I look at it this way, which is that each of these Republicans comes from a state or a district where he or she has to understand whether or not they're vulnerable in a primary challenge, let alone a general challenge. Enough of the Republican Party is absolutist on the subject of Trump that even if they aren't a majority of Republicans in many of these districts, they're the single most important factor among those primary voters and can very easily ambush a candidate. And so there's a kind of terror that has swept through the elected ranks of the Republican Party that while these people are not a majority, they're a large enough and cohesive enough minority that they can end my political career. And there's no politician, Republican or Democrat, who willingly commits political suicide, having worked so hard to arrive at this position of public power, prestige, and influence. So that's one issue. I think the other is that we're part of a longer political cycle in which liberal democracy is in such deep need of renovation, and not just of restoration of some kind of pre-Trumpian, pre-Bushian, pre-Reagan liberalism. I don't think we can go back to the era of Johnson and Kennedy, let alone to the era of Roosevelt. But how to go forward, how to balance internationalism and nationalism, how to balance multiculturalism with the hunger for a common national purpose, how to think about the virtues of economic growth and the trade-off in terms of global environmental despoliation and ever-increasing inequality as a characteristic of that growth, these are things which the Democrats are not yet coherent on. They're struggling toward them. They see where they need to go, but they can't yet get there politically with a unified message. And that is as damaging to the Democrats as anything that Trump does. Trump benefits from that void on the Democratic side of the aisle that isn't his creation and isn't his success story. It's a story of a failing within the Democratic Party that has to be rectified in order to battle him effectively.
Well, Richard Parker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it's always good to talk with you, and I think you always raise the right questions, and even if none of us can come up with the right answers as quickly as we'd like.
Well, I get mail from people saying, well, you know, you always tell us about how screwed up things are. Well, you know, why not, can't you tell us how to fix it? Well, I'm afraid that's above my pay grade. But thank you for joining us, Richard Parker.
Good to talk with you, Ian. Be well.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's the former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. And his books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith. His life, his politics, his economics. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the proposition that intelligence is no guarantee against stupidity.
Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television.
You're the first person I've had over to the house since my dad went nuts.
Nuke the whales? You don't really believe that, do you?
I don't know. Gotta nuke something.
Touché.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Vince Houghton, who is the historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., as well as the host and creative director of the museum's podcast, Spycast. He is a veteran of the U.S. Army, having served in the Balkans, and his latest book just out is Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vince Houghton.
Great. Thanks to be here.
Well, thank you. And it just emerged from a group in London that led by Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was a Russian oligarch who fell afoul of Putin, was jailed, had his fortune confiscated, and now is operating a kind of think tank in London that gets hold of Russian documentation. He's managed to get documentation from the Russian troll factory run by Putin's chef Prigozhin, and some of the plans that they had or have floated to destabilize the United States with what they called active measures sort of ring a little bit like your book, maybe not as crazy, but one of them, of course, that got some attention is the idea that the Russians were suggesting that you could go out and recruit a bunch of African-American gangbangers, send them to Africa for demolition training, and then bring them back to the United States to wreak havoc and create a kind of black homeland in the South, secede from the Union, if you will, and create what a writer for The Root called Black Manistan. So that was pretty bizarre. But I just thought I'd start out with a little contemporary reality, if you like.
Well, a lot of those aren't dramatically different from a lot of the plans that we had going the other direction of trying to foment relationships within the Soviet Union that would break up the kind of different ethnic groups, certainly within the Caucasus and different countries that now end in Stan, that have a predominantly Muslim population. And under communism, the Muslim population was essentially stamped down. And we did a whole lot during the Cold War to try to get them to create unrest against the central government in Moscow. So this is nothing new. And certainly the Russians aren't the only ones to think of things like this.
So tell me how you got into these archives and how you got all of this stuff out. And your book, of course, is buttressed by many of the people that were involved in some of these more extraordinary schemes. So obviously we'll talk about some of the extraordinary plots and plans that mercifully didn't get off the drawing board. But nevertheless, tell us about the methodology here in terms of prying this stuff loose. Were the agencies like the CIA somewhat embarrassed to let this stuff out, or is it all sort of in the distance and we can sort of look back with a laugh?
Yeah, I mean, there's a level of embarrassment. A lot of the reason that these documents exist is because people wrote memoirs, and the people who wrote memoirs mentioned things here and there, and that allowed for historians like other people and historians like me to tackle some of these issues that we wouldn't have otherwise. Like, once you get a piece of thread kind of coming out from a garment, we can just start grabbing and pulling it. And in many cases, the CIA is willing, if the information's already out there and they realize that there's no real reason to send sources and methods or no real national security reason to keep something secret, there is a willingness to declassify things. And so there were programs and there were technologies that there was no reason whatsoever to keep classified. And so over the past, some of these stories were declassified a little while ago. They just haven't been told all that much lately. But there are also stories in this book that were just declassified. And whether it was something that I was involved in or something that other people did, there was a movement to try to get as much information as possibly could for programs that didn't have any kind of national security issue with the level of secrecy that they, for whatever reason, that they maintained.
Well, of course, to some extent, my understanding, having spoken to a lot of former CIA people, that they don't mind the way that so much of the public attributes, and all these sort of, a lot of novelists attribute all kinds of diabolical skills, incredibly clever schemes, and all kinds of nefarious, bizarre, futuristic things that are going on at Area 51. So you have that on the one hand out there. But what your book does, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board, Vince Houghton, sort of pricks that bubble, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of sea officers that are actually pretty happy about that as well. There's a benefit to people thinking that you're an idiot. they take you less seriously. They might not, be willing to put as much effort into making sure that they're protecting themselves against you. If they think that you're bumbling and stumbling, then you have an advantage over them. They're not in a position where they're being overly eager to protect themselves. And the CIA doesn't necessarily always come out and refute against sometimes erroneous arguments that they made a mistake or that they failed or that they're kind of silly. The last thing the CIA really wants is a bunch of news articles saying how good they are and how effective they are and talking about their methods and how great they are at recruiting people from other countries and listening into your communications and breaking into your networks. That's not what the agency wants people to know. The agency wants people to kind of not think about them at all. Or if you are thinking about them, to kind of think, I'm not too worried about these guys. Like, all the news stories I read about them make them look like Keystone Cops. I'm not going to take them all that seriously.
So it's kind of the Pink Panther approach to intelligence.
Yes, sure.
And again, I'm speaking with Vince Houghton, who's a historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., as well as the host and creative director of the museum's podcast, Spycast. He is a veteran of the U.S. Army, having served in the Balkans, and his latest book just out is Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. So let's start with Acoustic Kitty, because I had heard something about that some time back, and as you mentioned, there are two different versions of Acoustic Kitty, where I take it the targets were Russians, right? I don't know whether did this happen in Russia, where they, I don't know whether you could have done all those operations in Russia. So walk us through the setup, if you will, Vince.
It's likely this happened in the United States. The idea for Acoustic Kitty more than likely came from Istanbul, where American CIA officers were observing the Soviet compound in Istanbul, the Soviet embassy, and they watched. If you've been to Istanbul, there's wild cats everywhere. There's just kitties all over the place, and if you like cats, it's a wonderful place to be. And they observed these cats just with impunity going in and out of the Soviet embassy compound, into the courtyard, and sometimes even walking right in the door. And in some cases, it would jump up on a park bench in the middle of the courtyard and just kind of nuzzle into the laps of a Soviet government person, maybe an intelligence officer or a military officer, and just sit there and get, pet. Well, this sparked this idea of like, well, what if we couldn't infiltrate a listening device inside one of those cats? And Project Acoustic Kitty was a real program. That's actually what it was called. So someone at CIA had a sense of humor about that. And the idea was to implant surgically a listening device inside a cat. The power pack would be inside the abdomen. The microphones would be up inside the ear canal so that the ears themselves could filter the sound down into the microphone. And the tail would be the antenna, in which way you basically would have a living bug that could basically walk right up to a target and arguably even jump inside their lap. And the Russians have no idea that they're giving ear scratches to a CIA agent.
So what could go wrong?
Well, so it depends on what version. Both versions have something that went wrong. One version was that the CIA got the electronics correctly. I mean, they were able to actually make a cat listening device that worked out pretty well. But the key is they had to train this cat to do what they wanted to go on a secret mission against the Soviets. And anyone who's been around cats for 10 seconds realizes that when I say train the cat, they kind of laugh to themselves, because that's just not going to happen. And so the CIA realized very quickly that they could spend as much money as they wanted to and as much time as they wanted to. The likelihood of them actually training a cat to follow instructions, at least enough so they can actually do a mission, was not going to happen. And so they closed up shop. They decided to cancel the program after they realized that was not going to happen. Now, that's one version of the story. The second one is they ran into the same problem, that they couldn't train the cat, but the way it's told is that this program was happening simultaneously with a program called MKUltra. And MKUltra was a CIA program to investigate mind control properties. And most people, if they've heard of MKUltra, think about it within the realm of LSD and hallucinogenic drugs to try to get people to be more compliant under interrogation or to train our guys to be able to resist interrogation. But MKUltra was actually about 150 different programs, and one of them included, at least one of them, maybe two, including using electronic stimulation on animal brains to try to override instincts, to try to get them to do what we wanted them to.
So the other story of Acoustic Kitty was that they went back into the cat surgically, and they rewired its brain so that it would not get hungry, so that it would not decide to stop and lick itself, so that it would not go and walk off and do whatever the hell it felt like it. They rewired the cat so that it would pay attention and do what we wanted it to. And then they were ready to field test it. And it was when the field test happened, according to this story, is when the tragedy struck. Because as happy as the CIA techs were that the Acoustic Kitty was doing exactly what it was designed to do, I guess it got too excited and didn't pay a lot of attention to traffic patterns. Because when they let Acoustic Kitty out on the street to run across to listen into a communication or a conversation across the street, they didn't realize that a taxicab was coming, and poor Acoustic Kitty, and the millions and millions of dollars we spent on trying to develop it, was crushed on Connecticut Avenue here in Northwest Washington, D.C.
And I like the movie version.
Yes.
So I know the Brits are good at coming up with some bizarre schemes. The aircraft carrier that was an iceberg or carved, how far did that one get?
So this was a project called Project Habakkuk, and it was a relatively ingenious idea. You know, what is unsinkable? Well, a big honking iceberg would be unsinkable, and if we could turn that into an aircraft carrier, then we could have a invulnerable platform to launch attacks in World War II against the Germans in Europe. What made it even more possible was an invention called Pikecrete, where two American inventors actually found out that if you mixed wood pulp, so what you make newspapers out of or paper mache, in with ice, it actually increases the strength exponentially. It makes ice almost as strong as steel. So you could build this large aircraft carrier out of Pikecrete, and not only would it be completely invulnerable to submarines or bombs, but it could be big enough and powerful enough that you could land the largest aircraft on it that you wanted to. This got all the way to the scale model stage, where in Two Lakes inside Canada, they built scale models of these aircraft carriers, and they tested them for, you know, one of the testing areas was the real fun one, where they just shot stuff at it, like torpedoes and bombs and guns, to see how resistant it was to enemy action. The other one where they actually kind of built the model and tested its seaworthiness. The problem they found is that if they built one of these things, just a single aircraft carrier, it would cost more resources than the British were spending combined on the rest of the war.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
So another World War II. Tell us about the idea of bat bombs.
Yeah, so this was another ingenious idea. Actually, one that might have worked. It certainly worked in proof of concept. So the idea behind this was that we all know from elementary school that bats during the day will do everything they can to find a cool, dry, dark place. And in some cases, that's our attics or easements or nooks and crannies inside our houses. Sometimes that's caves. This concept was understood. Now, if we combine this concept with a small incendiary device, a small napalm bomb, and we drop these bats over Japan, they will find their way into cool, dark, and dry places. Now, that meant, in many cases, they'd find their way into the attics and eaves and nooks and crannies inside Japanese houses or buildings, all of which in the 1940s were made of wood and paper, which is problematic for the Japanese if they want to resist fire. Now, in the United States, in Washington, D.C., we have a lot of buildings made of cement, a lot of buildings made of, you know, metal and steel. This would not be effective against those. But the Japanese didn't. Most of their country was wood and paper. So the concept was, if we had enough of these bats and we had enough of these little incendiary devices, we could drop, you know, thousands of bats over Japan and win the war without sending in a single American troop to try to fight against the Japanese military. We would just burn Japan to the ground. Simple concept. They tested this, and they actually tested this a lot. And on one of the more successful tests, they put the bats into hibernation to bring them from the cave area to the testing site. And the testing site was in Southern California. And they'd built a whole mock Japanese city to have as a test of a proof of concept test. What they did was they miscalculated. They brought the bats out of hibernation too quickly, and a lot of the bats woke up before they were ready for them to wake up. And so when they opened the doors of the truck that the bats were being carried in, the bats exploded out and went in every direction. Well, about half of them went straight for the Japanese city, the fake Japanese city, and did exactly what we wanted it to. It burned it to the ground. It worked perfectly. Problem was, the other half of the bats went straight for a working, active U.S. Army airfield. And all the barracks and hangars and control towers and planes, and burned that to the ground. So you can look at this kind of glass half empty, or also glass half full. Does that work too? All right, there was a proof of concept that worked as well. Now, we would have rather have not burned down a U.S. Army airfield, but it proved that the bat bomb concept would work. So all that was left to do was to get full funding to ratchet this up to a production level. So you had to make tens of thousands of these little bombs and go and capture tens of thousands of these bats. Well, they went to the head of the Navy, because this is a Navy program, and asked for the money for this. And this was in the summer of 1945. So the head of Navy, Chief of Naval Operations, was read into all American secret programs. He said, why in the world would we want to have bombs affixed to bats when in Los Alamos, New Mexico, they're building two bombs that are going to end the war on a single day? And this is an interesting plan that may have worked if it wasn't for another technology that superseded it. And so that's a lot of the stories in this book are like that, to where it's not that they failed. None of these programs actually failed. They just never got the chance to succeed. Well, in some cases, they never got the chance to fail. They were overcome by the war ended, or new technology was invented, or someone decided to go in a different direction with budgetary considerations. So this is a great example of something where we can look back historically and be like, you know what? That might have worked. As crazy as it sounds, that might have worked.
Well, of course, the one that did work, except it was betrayed by a Russian spy within the FBI, was Operation Monopoly. And I think it was 1948 in Berlin, the CIA and the Brits dug a tunnel into the Soviet part of Berlin to spy on them. And that was betrayed by Philby, the famous British spy for the Russians. So there's a certain connection there, is there not?
Yeah, and it was betrayed by Philby and a man named George Blake, who was also a British spy. No, there's absolutely a parallel there. Incidentally, the International Spy Museum where I work, we have a big chunk of the Berlin Tunnel, what you're talking about, Operation Gold, that was recovered after it was broken up. It was quote-unquote discovered. They knew about it for years until they found it. And it's similar to the one that happened here in Washington, D.C. in the 1980s, where we, meaning the NSA and the FBI, decided to dig a tunnel under the Soviet embassy and try to tap into Soviet communications within the embassy. And so what we did was we bought the house next door and across the street. And in the living room of the house next door, the FBI and the NSA team dug down inside the living room and then dug underneath the Soviet embassy. The problem was the FBI had been infiltrated by Robert Hansen, the infamous spy who was at the very high levels within FBI and who was spying for the Soviet Union for almost two decades. And so, again, it was kind of doomed before it started. It was the Soviets knew it was coming and were able to implement some countermeasures against it. But it was a pretty ingenious idea of, you know, let them have this embassy, let them build this embassy, but let's listen to every single word that's being said there as we go.
So what did they do with all the dirt they were digging up?
Well, the good news is the embassy itself was being built at the time. So it was a construction site already. And so they were able to kind of collect the dirt. And if you've ever seen the movie The Great Escape, where they're kind of walking around and dumping the dirt out the bottom of their pants, That was very similar in this case, to where at night, when the construction site only had one or two security guards, they would go just dump the dirt into the construction site of the embassy compound. And so no one would be any the wiser, because it would just look like it was all the dirt that had been dug up while the embassy was being built.
We're going to take a brief station break and be back continuing the conversation with Vince Houghton, the author of Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. But they beg you, wait my name.
a secret agent, man. Beware of pretty faces that you find. A pretty face can hide an evil mind. Oh, be careful what you say, or you will give yourself away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret Asian.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with Vince Houghton, the historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and the author of the new book just out, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. So the title, Nuking the Moon, is one of the many bizarre plots and plans that you have written about in your new book, Vince. So how in God's name did they come up with that one? Because, you know, you think in retrospect, it could have done something really terrible, you know, to the moon, not the least of which is Armstrong and company might have been irradiated when they set foot on the moon. But how did that one get as far as it did? And describe it, if you will.
Yeah, so in 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik into space, the first artificial satellite. And this is something that scared Americans silly. Not only did they launch Sputnik on top of what could be a Soviet intercontinental ballistic missile, but Sputnik showed that the Soviets had actually passed the United States in a certain area of science and technology. And this is something we couldn't allow to happen. It was all important that we be seen as the country that was a leader in the world in science. So the Air Force decided, let's do something that will truly get the attention of the world. What if we detonate a thermonuclear weapon on the surface of the moon and do it so along what's called the Terminator? The Terminator is the separation between the light side and the dark side of the moon, so that everyone on Earth who can see the moon at the same time, which is, you know, half the planet, would be able to watch this beautiful mushroom cloud rising on the moon and understand how powerful America truly was.
Wow. Well, would that have been whose idea that would be the response?
Well, the problem was that the Air Force learned, sadly, from the scientists who were brought onto this, that you would not get this gorgeous mushroom cloud. That mushroom clouds happen in dense atmospheres. They happen on places like Earth. Because as the expanding and rising hot gases and smoke end up running up into the air above it and the atmosphere above it, and that's what kind of smushes it down like the top of the mushroom. Well, there's no atmosphere on moon. The moon is basically a vacuum already, and so you wouldn't get this gorgeous mushroom cloud. You would just get a bright flash and then a bunch of dust flying in different directions. And for me, there's no great answer. There's actually one of these great stories where we don't know why it ended. But the most likely culprit was the Air Force found out that there would be no iconic, beautiful mushroom cloud that you'd see from Earth, and said, oh, what's the point then? If we're not going to see the kind of stereotypical, awe-inspiring mushroom cloud, then there's no reason to do this plan.
Well, how much, though, does that thinking, that mindset, fit into part 4 of your book, Fun with Nuclear Weapons? Because, you know, there was that whole idea, you know, to make the atom friendly, after all of the paranoia about the Soviet bomb and stuff. And, I mean, you've got some chapters here, the Plowshares Program, Strangest Idea, Protecting the Peacekeeper, Project Iceworm, Aircraft, Nuclear Propulsion, and Project Orion, and Project A-119.
Yeah, so this is a time in which the scientists who developed atomic weapons were trying, they knew they couldn't put the genie back in the bottle. They couldn't uninvent the atomic bomb. But maybe they could find peaceful uses for nuclear weapons. I know that sounds kind of paradoxical, peaceful uses for the world's most dangerous weapon. But the Plowshare program was just that. It was a series of proposals to try to find ways to use nuclear weapons to help humanity, to build passes through mountains, to artificially create harbors, to create ways to do mining a lot easier if you kind of go for natural gas reserves, and you can use nuclear weapons to release a lot of these natural gases. So there are a lot of really interesting proposals. One of them was a proposal to try to use nuclear weapons to either destroy hurricanes or to redirect hurricanes so that they don't hit populated areas. This is one of the stranger ideas, the Project Plowshare. It was one that was serious. A serious meteorologist came up with this idea, but was never really tested. But the problem was the only way to test this was to actually do it. And no one was willing to take the chance that you fail, and then all of a sudden you have an irradiated hurricane traveling at 200 miles an hour with glow-in-the-dark rainwater.
Oh, God.
And, you know, blasting into Miami. It's bad enough. I'm from Miami. I've lived through 12 hurricanes in Miami. And they're bad enough when they're not radioactive, when it's just normal rainwater and not, like, uranium-filled rainwater. So this was something where, although the meteorologist thought it might be an idea worth pursuing, there was no way to test this without actually doing it, and that was just not going to happen.
So is there a connection here to these bizarre schemes and, in general, the idea that there's obviously a lot of money that goes into the defense budget? Is this a case of sort of boondoggleitis, I guess, I'm making up a word there?
No, I think that's a little too cynical way of looking at this. I think obviously the money was there, and these would never have even been thought about if there wasn't funding behind them. But in many cases, if we're not super cynical about this, this is a time during World War II and the height of the Cold War where Americans and the British and the West were terrified of the possibilities of the end of existence. In World War II, it was the Nazis and the Imperial Japanese could actually end our existence. And, of course, during the Cold War, the Soviets and their 65,000 nuclear warheads could end the existence of all life on Earth. And so in many cases, our engineers and our scientists were desperate to find something, anything, that could potentially give us a leg up over our adversaries. And so the combination of that desperation plus the unlimited funding from a government that was desperate to come up with any new and innovative idea to help us win these wars was where you get some of these plans. And look, desperation also led to things like GPS and the internet and satellites and drones and SR-71 spy planes and some of the most amazing innovations of the late 20th century. That's not what this book's about. There are other books about that. Go read those if you want to know more about those. This is not telling those stories.
Well, but there, you know, a lot of the James Bond movies, and of course, Ian Fleming did have a background in British intelligence. But from your book, some of the sort of evil geniuses in the Bond films aren't too far from what you've revealed in your book.
In many cases, they don't stand a chance. Yeah, I mean, the people in the book are more down that direction of evil genius than any Bond villain. I think if you portrayed a Bond villain like some of the people who are coming up with these ideas in the book, then people wouldn't believe you. They would say that you're too far over the top. I mean, in many cases, look, the head of the OSS research and development team during World War II was a man named Stanley Lovell. And when Lovell got the job, Bill Donovan, who was the head of the OSS, went to him and said, "You need to be my Professor Moriarty." Again, still another pop culture reference, the evil villain that goes head up with Sherlock Holmes and beats him on several occasions. "You need to come up with every dirty trick, every subtle underhanded act, everything that we can possibly do to fight this war as unfairly as we possibly can, because the team that fights the war fairly is a country that loses. So you need to be my evil genius." And Lovell had some extraordinary ideas. Some of them are in this book. Some of them aren't. Some of them are in his memoir that he wrote. But this is state-sponsored craziness. There's no such thing as a bad idea. Now go wreak havoc.
And again, I'm speaking with Vince Houghton, historian and curator at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. His latest book just out is Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. So just in closing, Vince, let's talk a little bit about some of the many devices that were supposed to kill Castro. I recall that Desmond Fitzgerald, who was the CIA station chief in Paris, had a walk-in, a guy called Colonel Cabela, who ended up being what they called a dangle, that he promised he could get close to Castro and kill him. And so the CIA supplied him with all kinds of peculiar tools, all of which have ended up in a museum in Havana.
Right.
But let's walk through some of these plans, exploding seashells, etc.
Yeah, I mean, some of them were to kill Castro. Some of them were to incapacitate him. Some of them were to embarrass him to where the people would rise up against him. One of my favorites was that Castro, every night before he went to sleep, would put his shoes out outside of his room, then someone would come along and shine them for him. And the idea was to put thallium salts inside his shoes. Now, what that means is essentially it's like Nair, something that you put on to do hair removal. And what thallium salts in his shoes would have done is would make his beard fall out. And the belief at CIA was that if his beard fell out, the machismo of Castro would be lost and that the people would stop following him because he wouldn't be the beard anymore. That's one of the ways CIA was thinking. They're also looking at ways to make him seem crazy. Castro gave a radio address every week, and the idea was to lace the radio station with LSD so that Castro would go on a high trip and then say gibberish on the radio, and then the people of Cuba would be like, the guy's lost his mind, let's rise up and kick Castro out. Then there are ones that are a little bit more lethal, including an exploding seashell. Castro was an avid scuba diver, and the CIA devised a gorgeous-looking seashell that was, according to them, Castro would be drawn to it because it was so beautiful. And when he picked it up, it would explode and it would kill Castro. Of course, there's the exploding cigars, which is, you know, very popular. There were cigars laced with botulism so that Castro would get sick. There were plans to send his ex-girlfriend in to assassinate him, which went horribly bad when Castro used that machismo that we talked about and basically seduced the woman who was sent to kill him for one last romp in the bed. And it just goes on and on, where for decades we tried to find innovative ways to take Castro out.
Well, just in closing, Vince Houghton, if you wouldn't mind making an appeal to our audience, which tends to be on the sort of liberal left side, they're pretty suspicious of the CIA to begin with. I often wonder why people blame everything on the CIA when they let the presidents off the hook, because after all, the CIA has been the favorite tool of the executive branch, and it's mostly U.S. presidents have used it with a vengeance. Even Jack Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs, where he said, I'm going to smash it into 1,000 pieces, ended up doing exactly what we're talking about, right? Using the CIA to kill Castro. So that notwithstanding, what would your pitch be to our audience to get your book?
Well, I'm probably just as liberal as they are. I've been very overt saying that my political persuasion is just to the right of Karl Marx. So I'm certainly not coming at this from a rah-rah USA, rah-rah CIA side. These are real stories from our history. And they're absurd in so many ways. And I take them with the absurdity that they deserve. I wrote this book with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek, with a sparkle in my eye, and treated them with the reverence they deserve, which is not very much. These are stories that kind of give us a warning about what could happen if we allow ourselves to be overcome by fear. What could happen if we allow ourselves to be overcome by desperation? In a microcosm, what actually happened after 9/11 in some respects, where our fear of the unknown prompted us to do things that we look back now and regret very much, like the Patriot Act and some of the provisions in that, or Iraq in 2003. You know, these are things that are kind of the descendants of some of these stories in this book, where fear and desperation led us down a path that we sure wish we hadn't gone down in retrospect.
Well, Vince Houghton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Vince Houghton, who's an historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., as well as the host and creative director of the museum's podcast, Spycast. He's a veteran of the U.S. Army, having served in the Balkans, and his latest book, just out, is Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with the man she loved. The headline.